Well, as we've been going through the holy days, the Moedim, I've been doing teachings on each one. But as we come to Passover, and I know most of you have celebrated Passover, intimately familiar with this time of year and this particular Moed, I thought what would be nice is to have three individuals from the congregation come up and share some personal insights about the Passover Seder itself. And to introduce this, I want to make sure we understand something here. You know, the Torah, four times, the Torah commands us to explain to our sons, to our children, what God did in his deliverance of taking Israelites out of Egypt. And over the thousands of years, the telling, which is the word Haggadah, the telling of the story grew into different traditions and different customs and beautiful traditions, and into what we call the Seder meal. Seder means order, like your prayer book's called a Siddur. It's the same word. Seder is the order of the Passover meal. And then at his Last Supper, it was a Seder. He didn't say, obey the Torah commandment, because we know we're supposed to obey the Torah commandments. He says, do this in remembrance of me. Do the Seder with its traditions, with its four cups of wine, with the matzah, with the afikoman, and with the dippings, and with all the different things that happened, because those were established at the time that Messiah came. In fact, at the Passover Seder, we take the youngest child who can read, and they stand, and they ask the four questions. And these four questions were well established when Yeshua was on earth. They found copies of these in some of the old ruins and records. It goes way back to the Second Temple times. And I sometimes wonder if, you know, as it describes in Luke chapter 2, near the end of the chapter, it says it was Joseph and Mary's custom to always go to Jerusalem on Passover, because the Torah commands that. And when Yeshua was 12 years old, they took him with them. When they started back home, he wasn't around. So they had to go back and find out where he was. And he was in the temple, talking to the leaders of the temple. It says they were amazed at his responses, at his questions, at his answers. And sometimes I wonder if they weren't discussing, since it was Passover, the four questions. Because the four questions go like this. A child stands up and says, Ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halelot? Why is this night different from all other nights? Then he asks four questions, which honestly don't seem to make much sense. One of those questions is, on all other nights, we do not dip even once, but on this night we dip our bread or our food twice. That was a question Yeshua would have read at his Seder table when he was a little boy. I think it's a very deep question. And if you're not following through the Haggadah, you miss it. Because there were two dippings in the Torah. One dipping is what was the catalyst for bringing the Israelites to Egypt and to the exile. What dipping was that? Yes, Joseph's coat. His brothers took his coat, dipped it into blood, presented it to the father, and said, identify this, if you will. And that is the thing that triggered their moving to Egypt and the exile there. There was another dipping, which was the catalyst that brought them out of Egypt. What was that? They took the hyssop and dipped it in blood, and they put on the mezuzot, the doorpost, and the lintel of their doors. And the next morning they left. A dipping is what sent them there, and a dipping brought them out, both times in blood. One was the dipping of Joseph's coat. Who's Joseph a picture of? Yeshua. The other was the dipping of the hyssop into the Pesach lamb's blood. Who's the Pesach lamb a picture of? Yeshua. The Seder and the Haggadah. There are all kinds of them you can get, and they're ones we have available for you. Are filled with this imagery. Filled with it, was established as part of the oracles that God entrusted to the Israelites and as part of our inheritance as Messianic believers. And so we're going to hear from three individuals this morning. The first one is Brian Kima, and he's going to talk about the Seder, images of the Exodus. After him will be Tim Pell, who will talk about the Seder, understanding Yeshua's last meal. And third and final will be Dan Remark, talking about the Seder, passing our faith on to the next generation. So, Brian, without further ado, invite you up, and you're welcome to sit. And I've left enough water for the other three of you here if you get thirsty. So you can stand, you can sit, and when you're finished, we'll just invite them to come straight on up then, as soon as Brian's done. Thank you, Brian. Mm-hmm.
For the sake of time, we'll hold off on questions today. So about 1 year ago at this same time, some of you know I'm in the travel industry, right? So 1 year ago at this time, I got an invite to test out this new cruise line in the Caribbean and on this new cruise ship. I got to bring my good friend Ben Alger with me, but we were a little bit hesitant to go on this cruise because it was going to be over the time of Passover. And so after a little bit of introspection and thinking, we both realized, you know, being on a cruise isn't that much work. So I think we can still observe the commandment to remember Passover while sailing the high seas of the Caribbean. So we went. Now, check it out. The first night we get on our cruise, we sit down at the dining room table, and this nice Jewish couple sits right next to us. So, like, right away, Ben Alger asks them, hey, you two are Jewish. Are you observant? They say, yeah. They say, well, Ben says, are you going to have a Seder later on this cruise? And they said, yes, and they invited us to join them. Now, between Ben, myself, and the Jewish couple, we had like zero ingredients for a Seder, except the Jewish couple had brought some matzah. So the Jewish couple gives what looks like a Seder grocery list to the staff on the cruise ship. And they amazingly pulled together parsley, carousette, horseradish, roasted lamb bone, hard-boiled egg, complete with a small dish of salt water, wine, and candles for our Seder. The staff on the ship was literally like our version of the Egyptians, and we plundered them. Except instead of Egyptians, they were all Indians, but like it's cool, you know? All right, it was one of like the coolest Seders I'll ever be a part of. Here I am on this beautiful, multi-million dollar cruise ship with my good buddy Ben Alger and this observant Jewish couple observing Passover. Yet, it was also one of the most disappointing Seders I'll probably ever be a part of. As we read through this Jewish couple's Haggadah, it was quickly apparent that like something was missing. I didn't think about that going into it. And that thing was Yeshua. See, for those of us who believe in Yeshua, the Passover Seder, it really comes alive, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's like when we observe our first Passover, we say like, oh, now I get it. It's not just a story about God leading his people out of Egypt. It's a clear picture of salvation through Jesus. Forgive me for intermixing Jesus and Yeshua today. My dad's going to be listening on the podcast, so he does not speak Hebrew, you know. All right, so let's dig into the story of Passover and see the awesome connection between God providing rescue for his chosen people from the slavery and bondage of Egypt and God providing rescue from the slavery and bondage of sin through Yeshua. Now, there's so many cool pictures here, but I'm only going to touch on like three or four. So, Grant, you'll have to do it later. Okay, first, the Passover story begins with the Israelites, a holy people, entrapped in the bondage and slavery by the Egyptians. Now, in Hebrew, the word Egypt actually means narrowness or slavery, oppression, bondage. No, husbands, I'm not confusing Egypt with marriage. Sorry. Grant, I'm going to clean it up, I promise. Hang tight. All right. So, God calls Moses to tell Pharaoh to let the sons of Israel go. As you know, Pharaoh doesn't let them. So, God sends the 10 plagues on Egypt. Now, or the Egyptians. One of the most interesting things I've learned here at Beth Tikkun is the purpose of the plagues. See, the Egyptians worshiped false gods. And as I learned, the various plagues that were sent on Egypt were representations of the gods, of the false gods that the Egyptians worshiped. The Egyptians, some of the gods they worshiped were frogs, the sun, the Nile. So God sends them a ton of frogs, way too many. He turns the Nile, their source of life, into blood, a symbol of death, and then gives them 3 days of darkness with no sun. Exodus 10:21 says that the darkness could even be felt. So why are the plagues against the false gods the first part of the Israelites' deliverance? Well, the Ten Commandments actually give our answer. The Ten Commandments start with, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now, what comes right after that? You shall have no other gods before me. Now, these two steps, I believe, go in an important order that shouldn't be missed. After acknowledging that it's God who saved us from the bondage of sin and slavery, we're then called to put off our false gods. And that's when we begin our life of walking with God. Now, I know many in this room have cool stories about the false gods they've put off as a result of believing in God, including myself. But maybe you still need to rid yourselves of these false gods. For many, maybe you struggle with an addiction. Maybe you're addicted to work. It's like God's going to say, okay, I'm the one who saved you from the slavery of sin and death, and now you're going to put work above me? Well, all right, I'm going to give you more work than you can handle. You're going to get super stressed. You're going to start lashing out on your wife. You're going to lash out on your kids. It's going to affect the way you treat your colleagues, your coworkers, your clients, your suppliers. Okay, I'm getting carried away. But you get it, you know? It's like it just happens. Maybe your addiction is to lust, pornography, inappropriate sexual desires. It's like God saying, you're going to put that above me? I brought you out of that. All right, here, if you want to put that above me, you can have so much of it that you're going to become absolutely sick to your stomach. It's going to affect your children, affect your grandchildren, affect your spouse. Fighting off false gods is something we continually do. Just because the Israelites were led out of Egypt, out of the hand of Pharaoh, and across the Red Sea, they still had to fight the Amalekites for the rest of their lives. Now, Grant's taught me that Amalek actually means a people that licks up. Kind of crazy, but it's a picture of the flesh. Even though the Israelites were a saved people, they still needed to fight Amalek all the time. See, God takes care of the things we can't take care of, like freeing us from the slavery to sin by defeating Satan and his kingdom. However, we're called as believers to fight the desires of our flesh daily. Once I understood this, I finally started to see changes in my life. If you're struggling with sin, you need to step up and fight. When Yeshua is tempted in the desert in Matthew chapter 4, he has the word of God on the tip of his tongue, and he's ready to combat sin with it. Okay, we come to the 10th and final plague. This plague's pretty straightforward. God's going to kill the firstborn of the Egyptians. But there's instructions for the Israelites to make that distinction. Exodus 12:3, God says, speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves, according to their father's households, a lamb for each household. A little bit later, your lamb shall be an unblemished male a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. I asked Grant, what was up with the lamb being a year old? He said, well, the Passover lamb didn't have to be a year old, but rather less than a year. In other words, it had to be a lamb and not a sheep, which is full grown. This pictures our Messiah, He was crucified in the prime of his life. His heart was tender and gentle. He was full of innocence. It's a cool picture. Exodus 12:7. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. A couple thoughts on this. Why the blood on the doorposts? Well, it's so God knows not to kill the Israelites and to kill the Egyptians, right? It's kind of like, shouldn't our God, who's omniscient, all-knowing, be able to recognize the difference between the Israelites and the Egyptians? Does he really need a reminder? Well, there's an interesting thought in Judaism, I think it's a tradition, that the Israelites actually put the blood on the inside of the door, not the outside. Well, if they put the blood on the inside, then how could they have even seen the blood? The only ones who can see the blood on the inside would be those who are on the inside, right? And the lesson here is that putting the blood on the door isn't for God to remember. It's for us to remember. And it's a reminder that you're willing to follow God's instructions. And when the Israelites were given these instructions, they did exactly that. Exodus 12:28 says, Then the sons of Israel went and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. Notice how they didn't wait. They didn't wait to feel conviction to put the blood on the doors. They didn't wait to make sure the timing was good. And they definitely didn't say, well, how come the Egyptians aren't doing it? And so it is with following God's commands as a saved people. He calls us to keep his Torah all the days of our life, not just when we feel it fits our schedule or when we feel convicted. Now, let's talk about the painting of blood on the door for a minute. So, an interesting aspect to putting blood on the doorpost is that on a typical door frame has three sides, right? Two vertical posts and then a post on top of it. And if you've been coming to Beth Dikun for a while, or if you've been listening online, you've probably heard Grant talk about this idea that Yeshua, when he was crucified, he may very well, historically stated too, would have been crucified on a cross that looked like a door frame, or the letter Chet. In Hebrew, Chet means cross, and it's pictured just like a cross, two vertical posts with a post on top of it connecting it, right? Now, the first time you heard this, you might have been rubbed the wrong way a little bit, like I was, when you heard this possibility that maybe Jesus wasn't crucified on a cross that's shaped like a T. Because growing up in the church, the cross was the central symbol of my faith, and it's a very sacred object. A good Christian family should have crosses all over their house. People should have crosses on necklaces around their neck. And for me, it was upsetting to hear this possibility that maybe Jesus wasn't crucified on a cross that I'm familiar with. Now, I have a good friend who comes from a Jehovah's Witness background. The other day, he was telling me how in Jehovah's Witness religion, they don't believe that Jesus was hung on a cross. They believe it was a single wooden stake, just a vertical stake from the ground. Jesus' hands would have been crucified above his head and his feet right below him. No cross, just one stake. He tells me that when he sees a depiction or picture of Yeshua being crucified on a cross that's shaped like a T, he gets really uncomfortable, and he really doesn't like it. Now, honestly, I don't know much about the Romans, and while the idea of a cross being shaped like a chet does sound very convincing, and the symbolism of Yeshua being hung on a cross that looks like that in regards to a doorframe with the Passover and the blood over the doorframe, it seems really, really cool. The truth is, I don't really know. But I do know that many people, including myself, we seem to get upset when we hear opposing views on the structure the Romans used to crucify Jesus. Hang on to that thought. I'm going to loop it back around. Give me a sec. About 6 weeks ago, I received a last-minute opportunity to travel to Israel. Super cool, by the way. On the last day of my travel there, I got to visit Galilee, and I had the coolest tour guide ever. Young man, he grew up as a Jewish Galilean fisherman. So all his life he grew up in Galilee, having no real idea about Yeshua. When he was like 20 years old, he decided he wanted to learn more about this mysterious figure from his hometown who his parents would strangely ignore. Now this tour guide, now in his early 30s, has become extremely curious and excited to learn about Jesus. That's all he wants to talk about. And he feels like he can relate so well to Jesus because this tour guide's a fisherman from Galilee, right? Now, during that day in Galilee, my small group of primarily Christians, we visited the Mount of Beatitudes, where we got to read from Matthew 5 and 6. We visited the synagogue in Capernaum, and more recently discovered one in Magdala, where Yeshua would have taught. And all day long, we kept digging into the Gospels to prep us for the next spot we were traveling to. And oddly enough, on our last stop in Galilee, we finished at a Roman Catholic church where Yeshua was said to have fed the 5,000. Maybe you've been there. There were many crosses there, as you can imagine. And I think my tour guide said it best when it came to the cross and that being today's symbol of Christ. Now remember, this tour guide is a Jew from Galilee who has recently come to admire Jesus and still hasn't claimed him to be the Messiah. But he challenged our group. He said, "Okay, Christians, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you read the Gospels and you read what Yeshua said, how he constantly referenced the Torah in studying his commands, how he speaks of doing good deeds and living a pure, holy, blameless life, do you really think Jesus would have wanted to be remembered by the wooden Roman cross he was crucified on? Because it seems to me like everything he says in these books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John point to Jesus wanting you to remember him by what he said and what he did." Now, I have to say, I agree with my young Galilean Jewish tour guide. All too frequently, when I think of salvation, I only think of Christ dying, and I forget the life he lived. I only focus on the sins I've been forgiven of, as opposed to focusing on pursuing righteousness, godliness, holiness, the things that Christ calls me to follow. And while the idea of the blood on the inside of the door at Passover is a tradition, maybe the blood's on the inside for our benefit. Because painting the blood on the inside of the door is to remind those being saved of how they're being saved. Let's not focus on the door frame. Everyone has a door frame, even the Egyptians. It's the pure and sinless blood on the frame that saves us. Wrapping up, how does this affect us today, or this Monday night, when we observe our Passover Seder? Because we're not called to put the blood on the doorposts anymore. That was only done once in the history of Israel. We're just called to feast and remember. What's up with that? Well, here's a picture. Christ, our Lamb, died for us once and for all. His blood was perfectly shed on the cross, doorposts, one time. And just as the Israelites feasted on the Lamb to give them the strength to escape slavery, we feast on the true Lamb, the Word made flesh, so that we remain free and don't fall back into slavery. John 8:31-32, Jesus says, "So if you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." Continue feasting on the word. Tim, I'll invite you up now.
Thanks, Brian. That was great. I learned a lot, and I had never thought of marriage as bondage before, but I really appreciate that. It's a new insight. I assume, Grant, you want me to turn this on now and start recording? Because it is on. I'm stalling because I double-spaced my speech here, and it's about the same number of pages as Brian's, so bear with me. Sorry, Dan. Now, if you haven't had enough levity in this morning's teaching, have I got a treat for you. And you can go ahead and show that first slide, David. Yeah. All right. I was actually going to start off by embarrassing my wife thoroughly and say that we thought we were going to be hosting a Seder this year, but because we just bought a house, and as we're waiting to close, the house is a mess, and we're starting to pack, and we just didn't invite anybody, and we also hadn't been invited. I was going to make a shameless appeal, you know, and start the bidding, you know, soon after the lesson, but we prayed this morning on the way in. Sure enough, when we got here, someone invited us. So yeah, it's pretty cool. But all right, so the Seder, understanding Yeshua's last meal. In the Pell House, when we host a Seder, preparation begins at least 2 weeks beforehand, which is not unusual. You know, some may go as early as a month, or some may have thought of it on Wednesday of this past week. Tara and I are both very, very passionate about welcoming people and making them feel comfortable. So we take it real seriously. There's a menu to decide on and shop for, guests to invite, and a house to clean. I'll put together, of course, a playlist of music to play and time it. You know, I've taken my inspiration from Grant. I'll take my, you know, music in a different direction, of course, but throw a little R&B in there. And then meticulously set the table at least the night before, if not 2 nights before, making sure everything's just right. And all this preparation is done so that when we are finally gathered around the table, in the midst of it all, we can forget about it. Forget about it. It just disappears. But let me shift gears here for a sec. When we despair now. Despair is all about right now. We despair because we can't see past it. Whatever it is, the source of our despair. If you think back, take some time to think back, close your eyes, to the last time you were despondent, depressed, you'll know that it's true that that state of being can only endure if all we see is now, right? I see heads nodding, good. So how did you deal with that wretched time in your life? How did you move beyond it? I can guarantee that you at least did two things. One, you remembered. And two, you looked ahead. Often the best and only way to deal with your present darkness is to forget where you are by remembering where you've been and picturing where it is you want to be, right? By remembering that you have been through tough times before, that you are strong, and by imagining the enormous bowl of ice cream you'll reward yourself with when you have once again emerged victorious. Am I right? Little sprinkles on top, some chocolate sauce. Peanut butter ice cream is my favorite, by the way. So, Adam and Rosella, I hope you have that at your Seder. We're going to. What's interesting is that if you only do one or the other, it sometimes is not enough. Remember or look ahead. It's when you do both that it really helps to carry you through. I can imagine, in general terms, scenes from movies. I'm a real movie guy. I love action movies. A scene in a movie where the hero or heroes are faced with certain and impending death. I'm envisioning two soldiers on a battlefield. The enemy is swiftly approaching. They have no ammo left. There's no path to retreat. They're stuck and they know no one is on the way. They know they're going to die. It's inevitable. So what do? Well, they sit back, light a cigarette, and they tell stories. They talk about their girlfriends. They talk about the best steaks they ever had. They dream about riding motorcycles down Highway 1. Why? What's the point? They're not going to do those things again. They do those things to remind themselves that right now is not all there is. That they lived a good life and that it had worth. Then and only then can they face their shared destiny standing tall. Yeshua, on the night before his death, gathered with those closest to him and remembered. He remembered the Exodus, the past redemption, and reminded his disciples, and perhaps even himself, why he was doing all of this, the future redemption. Remember, look ahead. I like to think they also reminisced, too. Yeshua knew his friends were distraught, if not just a little bit in disbelief. I imagine him joking with them about the demon-possessed pigs running off into the water. Or poking fun at Mark for running off naked that one time. I know. What a hoot. Whatever he had to do to help them all forget about their present situation. Just maybe. Probably not, but maybe. What perfect timing, too, that he would have before his planned crucifixion. This antidote to hopelessness. Because you see, the Seder is a protest against despair. Next slide. That's what I just said. The Seder is a protest against despair. As soon as we start reading the Haggadah, we are no longer concerned with where and when we are. It's all about where we've been and where we're going. Sure, the physical surroundings are nice and shiny and a pleasure to be surrounded by in the moment, and especially at the Pell House, let me tell you. But internally, we are, hopefully, transported as individuals to our shared past and in pursuit of our shared destiny. In our retelling the story, we are planting a stake in the ground and declaring that we will not despair. We will not be afraid. We will ignore the world's deafness and indifference to our plight and think only on our blessed path to now and our continued sojourn together to paradise. We gather, we share, and we pass down. Now, before Dan gets up here, I want to go out on a limb and make a kind of generalization. I've been thinking about this a lot, and something that's related to this, but just kind of a little bit of a tangent, was made clear to me. And that is that Judaism is to remembrance what Christianity is to expectation. And so our Messianic Judaism is completeness, right? And again, I'm not, this is a generalization. I'm not saying that in Judaism they neglect or don't think about, they don't think ahead. Of course they do. And that in Christianity, where a lot of us came from, that we didn't remember where we've been. We don't, of course we do. But in my experience, and maybe some of your experience, your faith practice and experience on Sundays or whatever, the focus was in the expectation of heaven, of second coming, of the end of this suffering. And that I know Judaism is built upon remembrance. So, what I see here is that Yeshua connects the two. In his last meal, he is bringing these two together. And we do as well every time we participate in the Passover Seder. Thank you. Dan?
Thanks a lot, Tim. Appreciate it. Trying to see if we have one of the... It's all right. It's amazing. Well, for prayer service or doing something like this, just how certain things seem to run in a theme. It really is awesome. You guys remember the music from Mission Impossible? You know, dun 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 dun. And the voice says, "Good morning, Mr. Remark. Your mission, Dan, should you choose to accept it," put that in Grant's voice, was to share how the Passover Seder has impacted your own family. So Passover has really... No, I'm good. Thank you. You are so kind. Has really impacted our family quite a bit. For Valerie and I, it represents a true exodus from our lives where we thought we had a lock on the truth. And this festival has been the gateway to our new lives. Our exodus from living as we thought God wanted to living as God has instructed us, through the living Messiah, the way of truth. Our first Seder was at some friend's house, and we're still debating now which one that was, because there's a couple of them that kind of morph together, and they were just an eye-opening experience, as was stated earlier, probably has been for all of us. And we just couldn't believe the revelation that was being open to our eyes at the time. And that truly must have been the beginning of coming to Beth Tikkun. And then our first Seder that we held as a family and friends, because we had them kind of both mixed in, was something that our children will never forget. So, and we're still trying to pin down the exact year that was. Things start to change after a while. And we were all lined up. I know my dad was there, and my aunt was there, and friends were there, and we really had no idea what we were doing. And it was a warm evening. It was actually very nice. And DJ was supposed to open the door for Elijah. And when he went to open the door, all of a sudden, and I think we had an atrium door or something by us that was kind of already open, he opened the door and there was a flash of lightning and a peal of thunder that made even my stoic dad jump. And we really thought Elijah was coming in. It was burned into our memories. And there's the beginning of the impact that it had on my children's lives. Subsequent Seders have had other particular memories. One of them, as we were singing, always thought that I'd be an apostle sinking in a gentle pool of wine. Remember that from, I think Jesus Christ Superstar. always thought that I'd be an apostle. Right? And we'll go into the rest of that story. Some satyrs have gone on. One, we've lost a close friend or a family member that has left the world for higher ground. And some satyrs have been when we've added a new spouse to the family. One was held with Quentin via Skype as far away as Guam. That was interesting. One was held with a bride to be without Quentin away at war in Afghanistan. And then we had a satyr in California. That was pretty cool. We got to go out to California after being winter in Ohio. And I was as sick as a dog. I spent $800 to fly out to California to be sick. And so we get to the base, because at the time Abby and Quentin were living out in California, because Quentin was assigned out there as a Marine. And we go to the base PX, and we're going shopping, and I'm just dragging. I am so ill. And I'm picking up all those little things that we need, the horseradish, the parsley, the lettuce, and I'm picking it up, and Abby's like, "Are you sure?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I got it, I got it." And I was just, I couldn't believe how horribly sick I was. I actually had strep, and we didn't know it. But I had to do the cooking, which isn't good if you have strep. And that got about as far as me peeling the horseradish. And I remember showing Abby how to peel horseradish. It's a really cool way that chefs do it. You take a spoon and you just shave off the outer skin. It's really easy. It's amazing. And I'm just in a stupor. And then I stopped cooking because Valerie and Abby had to take over. It was just, I explained what to do, and I just went and sat. And as the evening's proceeding, I'm becoming more and more ill. And the really fun thing was is that Phil and Heather Rose live out in San Diego, and so they got to drive up, and you know, we all got to be together, and we're sitting there. And I think we have a slide, don't we? Remember that song? This is like my teaching of songs. One of these things is not like the other. One of these things just doesn't belong. Can you guess which one is not like the other? Right? So we get to the part where we're supposed to consume the horseradish, which is fairly nasty, right? And I'm about ready to die. And I consume what I thought was horseradish. It was actually ginger. Now, I'm a chef. I'm supposed to know the difference between the two. And I always know that you peel ginger with a spoon. And here I was peeling this ginger the whole time, and it wasn't even horseradish. It was at that point I got up and I went upstairs and I was done, and I went and took over the Seder. I'll never forget that. And I don't think Abby will either. Some satyrs have been with new babies. And one will soon... And one is being held with a baby just soon to arrive. It's a meal. And the saying is true. We are what we eat. No amount of instruction, me sitting down and discussing theology or life's lessons, would impact my family more than the celebration of this festival. Once is not enough. Twice is only practice. Year after year, Passover after Passover, these memories and this story become us. We take them into our soul. The Seder was just a meal for my kids. And then it became their history, part of their past. Now it is the present. It's in their lives. It's the events in life, reminding them of its teachings. The triumph of catching a yeasted item just before consumption only to become crestfallen because you were tricked by consuming something else brings home within your soul how easy it is to miss the bullseye. For all of us now, it is the future. It's a prophesied time when our Messiah will drink with us the fourth cup, the cup of praise, the cup of the kingdom. This remembrance, for that's what we are called to do, will go on. Our Master's command is to do this in remembrance of him. When I have died, and when my wife is laid to rest, I know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that within my family, this celebration of Passover, the story of my Redeemer, my Messiah, my children's source of salvation, my grandchildren's inheritance will be remembered. The story will be talked about how God made a covenant with a nation of people and brought them and their children and their children's children and the world salvation. Grant?
Wow, well, thank you so much, guys. We'll have to do this more often. I appreciate this. Yeah, go ahead. That's fine.
Passover truly is an amazing, amazing time of year. And I don't know why it never jumped out at me before, but during the second part of the prayer service, we read through Exodus chapter 12. And God says that on Passover, it says, on this day, I will stand as a guardian over the children of Israel, a sentinel over the children of Israel on this day, every year, forever. It's almost as if he continues to pass over us, to hover over. And when we are involved in the Seder, I think Elijah really is there. Elijah is always a picture of God's Spirit. And we have that empty place at the table. And I do believe that God is very present there and stands sentinel over us. So I appreciated the humorous stories everybody shared. I have one too, since we have a little time. I have to tell this one. Back when Beth Tikkun was smaller, we used to meet all together for a Seder. We just got too big for that. But I think one of the last times we gathered together as a Seder, we rented this hall out in Hartville. And there were probably about 80 or 100 of us there. And this is before my brother was married. And he's quite the thespian, you know. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if Elijah actually did show up at the Seder? So I posed this to Brian. I said, how would you feel about getting an outfit? We'll go down to the costume place, get you an outfit with the beard and the whole deal and sandals. And then when it's time for someone to open the door for Elijah, you come in and you can do a soliloquy of some sort. And he jumped right on it. That'd be great. So nobody knew this was going to happen. And so about halfway through the meal, Brian slips out. He gets all dressed and he goes outside the building. It's completely dark. And he's waiting for the time when someone comes to open the door. Well, my other sister-in-law, Mary Ann, decided I should call the babysitter just to see how the girls are doing. So she slips out the door into the dark to call the babysitter, and she sees Elijah. Her jaw drops. And my brother, in his deep voice, says, "Marianne, do not be afraid." And she about drops me. She says, "How did you know my name?" So anyways, that's one that I know she'll never forget. But you know, the reality is Elijah is coming back, and he will be a forerunner of our returning Messiah. It's going to happen, and that's a thrilling thing to expect and to look forward to. So I pray what is on the screen, may the miracle of Passover live on in your heart forever. And it truly is a miraculous day. And you must understand that in Jewish thought and biblical thought, we're not just looking back several thousand years to the Passover when Israel left Egypt or when Yeshua was crucified. We actually come to that day again. Every year we come around to that very day. We're not looking back at all. We are in that day. You understand? We circle around to where we're many laps ahead, but we're at the same place on the track, exactly the same time. And maybe there are things that you've been enslaved to, and God's been bringing judgment against the gods in your life. It always happens to me this time every year. Every year, God begins to judge things in my life that have crept up and begun to exert their influence in my life. And Passover comes, and there's freedom. So I pray that all of us experience freedom from whatever it is that's trying to enslave us during this time of year. So let's have a word of prayer, then I'll invite Tim up to lead us in the Braga. Our Father and King, we thank you so much for this time of our freedom, time of Passover and of unleavened bread. And help every one of us as we remove the physical leaven from our homes, that Father will remove the spiritual leaven from our lives. So each of us will be a house that's cleanly swept and is filled with your light, your purity, and the newness of walking in the life of Messiah. So Father, I pray that in our hearts, Elijah, your spirit would take up your presence within us. Make us the people you want us to be. And I pray that as we fulfill the commandment of the Master to do this in remembrance of him, that Father, you will be pleased with the season of our joy. We praise you for the privilege of observing this. We praise you for it all in the precious name of our Passover Lamb, Yeshua. Amen. Well, let's